Time once again for Dialogue Conspiracy with May Brussel. For the past 14 years, May has been researching and uncovering facts and evidence from between the lines of the news and placing them in a more thorough perspective of how conspiracy, political assassination, and abuses of power affect us all. Dialogue Conspiracy originates with KLRB-FM in Carmel, California. And now, May Brussel.
Good evening. This is May Brussel in Carmel, California. And it's January the 8th, 1978. This is Dialogue Conspiracy number 303. I started out this year being very optimistic. I had about 8 days of optimism. Now I'm not feeling so good. Certain things happened in the economy this Wednesday. Pledges the Federal Reserve made about money that can't be backed up in our gold supply, and new directions that I see in the newspaper that are discouraging to me. I'll share some of them with you and then get on with some other information. Larry Flint, the owner of the Hustler magazine that I spoke about a few weeks ago on Dialogue Conspiracy, pledged to Paul Krasner that he could run his magazine, and he's going to be taking over Hustler magazine. And I just heard that Flint's going to offer $1 million to the person who can solve the John Kennedy assassination. I heard that this is a new offer that's going to be put in his magazines. There's one catch, and that is that the money will be given to those people who are screened through by a panel of three people, specifically Mark Lane, Dick Gregory, and one other party. Now, that's very discouraging because Mark Lane moved out from Washington, D.C., where the House Select Committee is doing their research, supposedly, on the Kennedy assassination now. And instead of working with Congress, he's moved to the West Coast. And I feel that he and Dick Gregory will work with Don Fried and be one more agent of cover-up of the Kennedy assassination. I believe that Mark has been one of the biggest stumbling blocks to the truth in this affair, and I've been antagonistic towards him for years. There are very few of the researchers that respect Mark or can even stand him, and Dick Gregory is not a researcher. So I feel that this is a showbiz thing, and if any serious documentation is presented to them, it won't receive the credit, and the men will take pieces from it that might be of value and distort other material. I know that Mark Lane took credit in Washington to make sure that none of my information would get before the House Select Committee. He told them I was crazy and a kook and diverted it, so I know that he would do this for Larry Flint. I would hope that Paul Krasner, as the editor of Hustler, would present what I have to give to Larry Flint in good faith and not pass it in front of Mark Lane or Dick Gregory. There's one thing that did disturb me when Krasner took over Hustler magazine. He suggested the first article I write be about Son of Sam and the MK Ultra program, and then he suggested I do another article on the rock musicians, the killing of the rock musicians. But he said something really strange to me. He said, don't write about Lee Harvey Oswald. He says, that's kind of overdone. Don't get into the Oswald thing. Now, that's interesting because 2 weeks after he told me this, after Paul Krasner said that, Flint, who must have some consuming desire to know who killed John Kennedy, is coming out with this huge offer. And yet Krasner said to me, don't write about Lee Harvey Oswald. Now, I know, and I've said before in Dialogue Conspiracy, the thing that these people are afraid of, what they're most afraid of, is to expose or disrobe the plan of the assassinations, the overall plan that's gone on from the Tsarist Russia to the forming of Nazi Germany, the importation of Nazis to America, the use of Tsarists like Marina Oswald, George de Morenschild, the links to the oil company, the defense industry, to Wernher von Braun of NASA, and Walter Dornberger from Bell Aerospace, the use of Nazis in the assassination, Albert Osborne with Lee Harvey Oswald, the Defense Industry Security Command, the FBI, William Sullivan of Division 5. These are the things that will not be allowed to come out. The offer, from my own interpretation, so far is a sham. I will produce a serious document and try to get it to Mr. Flint and put it in a book form. He's going to have a book publishing company, and maybe he'll publish the book with my explanations. I would never present it to Dick Gregory and Mark Lane and believe that they were serious about wanting to know who killed John Kennedy. A new name cropped up in my research this week that's worth noting, and for those of you that take the tapes every week and keep getting books on the subjects and get informed on them, write the name down and let me know if you have any information about him, or go to the library and the indexes and see if you can find this name. It's Peter, P-E-T-E-R, Bessel, B-E-S-S-E-L-L. He lived in Oceanside, California. He seems to be missing, which is a syndrome that we get with these very important witnesses. The first time I heard his name was from David Osterlund several weeks ago with regards to a movie that's being made on the Kennedy assassination in Canada. I think I mentioned that on the show, and that Anthony Summers, the man who wrote The File on the Tsar, saw documents or knew this Mr. Bessel and said that Henry Kissinger had showed him information on the taking of the Tsar and the Tsar's family out of Russia, that the U.S. Army assisted in evacuation of the entire family of the Romanovs out of Russia at the time of the revolution, and that they were in fact alive and were never killed as depicted so many times in movies or in books. The second time I heard about Peter Bessel was this week from a KLRB listener in London, England, who gets the tapes of these shows. He was sending me a detailed breakdown of the English political system and the parties and their various conspiracies as they pertain to our United States intrigues. And he talked about the Liberal Party in particular and a man named Norman Scott who was going to be killed. Again, we have these near-murder assassination stories. The man, Mr. Newton, was to kill Mr. Scott of the Liberal Party. Mr. Newton lost his courage. He killed the dog instead and got an attorney and spoke about the plans to kill this particular member of the Liberal Party. He was a friend of Jeremy Thorpe, another leader of the Liberal Party in England. Mr. Newton came to the United States where a truck almost ran over him, such as the one that killed Murray Chotiner and ran over Clay Shaw in New Orleans, these important witnesses. A truck almost ran over him, and therefore he got very nervous, and he began to talk about who paid money for Mr. Newton who wanted him killed, that he received money. And the name that came out was Peter Bessel, who lives in Oceanside, California, a man obviously with the CIA or must be working close enough with Kissinger to have this special information on the departure of the Romanovs from Russia. Well, the killing or the near killing didn't take place, and the witness got terrified and he went to his lawyer, and now the lawyer is talking about a story which he's saying in London, according to the London sources that I have, that when this story comes out, it's going to be bigger than Watergate, that the story surrounding Peter Bessel and the reasons for wanting Scott killed is one of the biggest stories of the Western world, and if the true implications come out, it will shake the Western world. And that could only have meaning in terms of the political assassinations or the removal of the Romanovs to Poland, where they were taken, and they were not killed. And I think that the Kennedy assassinations and the removal of the Romanovs are part and parcel of the same problem. They're not separate. And I think, the implications of this story are big. So if any of you have ever heard of Mr. Peter Bessel, he's missing now. He lived in Oceanside, California, and I really would like some information about his relationships to Henry Kissinger or the political parties in London. If you take the London Times, let me know more about him, and let's see if we can put these pieces together. I spoke today with a researcher in Chicago, Sherman Skolnick, who had been very privileged. He has spent time with Alexei Nikolaevich, I can't pronounce it, Romanov, the son of the Tsar. He's seen him. He lives in New York City in Kew Gardens. I wrote to the Tsarevich, I wrote several months ago, about a half a year ago, wanted to see if I could contact him. I had his address. I have his number now. He went by the name of Colonel Golanevsky in Poland. He went to a military academy after he left Russia. Sherman Skolnick is a fine researcher, and he's absolutely convinced that this is the Tsar's son. He claims that the Chase Manhattan Bank has made an offer to settle for $80 million with this person if he doesn't put a claim on their holdings, because there's $400 million in gold in the Chase Manhattan Banks. It would break the Chase Manhattan Bank at this time if he pulled out his true inheritance, that it's sitting there. The Romanovs alone, not as the Tsar, but just as a family, had money, tremendous holdings with Marshall Field, with U.S. Steel, General Motors in the Midwest, Canada, and Illinois. And this particular party is only allowed to live on a pension given to him by the CIA. And he's afraid for his life and cannot make a claim on the fortune. He isn't living well, but he doesn't want to make a claim on the fortune. Sherman says he has proof positive that he is the Tsar's son. He came in the United States in 1967, right after John Kennedy was inaugurated, and Sherman Skolnick believes that was just one more reason to assassinate John Kennedy, that if he had surfaced and told his true story and claimed part of his wealth, the Rockefellers would be wiped out. And we know that George de Morenschild, who worked as Lee Harvey Oswald's closest CIA contact and friend, also worked with Nelson Rockefeller and the Chase Manhattan Bank ever since he came to the United States. He was a conduit. And the use of Oswald the Patsy to blame him instead of the higher-ups in government was very convenient, but Sherman feels that this was a very good motive that has never been brought out for another reason for getting rid of the Kennedys. When he arrived in Langley, Virginia, Alexei was met by a CIA agent who then turned out to be a KGB agent, the same person that he had known in the Soviet Union. His sister, Eugenie Romanoff, lives in Oak Park section of Chicago, Illinois, and she's still alive. Anastasia's in the United States in Maryland. I've talked about her before on this program with Lydia Blades when we talked about the book, The File on the Tsar. There's a book called Lincoln and the Tsar. I don't have the author, but I'm going to try and get it. Sherman Skolnick saw the book when he was in New York with Nikolai, and they talked about Alexei, rather, and they talked about this book. It claims that Mr. Seward, William Seward, was responsible for Abraham Lincoln's death. He was the Secretary of the State at the time, and of course they blamed John Wilkes Booth. That Seward also was responsible for the purchase of Alaska, called Seward's Folly at the time, but that the Tsar and the Romanovs actually owned Alaska, and that in 1966 there was an agreement which expired. And that one of the allegations of this party is that Armin Hammer, who went over to the Soviet Union and worked out this $40 billion deal for gas through the Bering Straits, was involved with working with the Romanovs and the Alaskan Territory. And legally, according to the explanation of Sherman Skolnick and Alexei Romanov, the Alaska Territory actually belongs to the Soviet Union, and that they're using it as a trump card. They could take Alaska back if they want, but it's a hold they have over the United States because they know the facts in this case full well, and keep this as a trump card for getting out of Vietnam or for making sure we don't go too far in our foreign policy with our weapons systems. He has documented dental proof from England of his charts going back as far as 1909. This party had hemophilia since birth, and he stays on a very strict regimented diet, which he claims has allowed him to live. Interesting that when this Colonel Golanovsky was brought to the United States and then identified as the son of the Tsar, the attorney that he had when he came here was Harry Rothblatt, who later became the attorney for Frank Sturgis and the Watergate defendants, and he blames Harry Rothblatt for letting him down and going along with the Rockefellers in New York City and with the CIA and not pursuing the claims because, in quotes, it would break Rocky's bank. Henry Rothblatt has been working for that team and was the attorney for Colonel Golanovsky when he came to the United States. The British archives are way ahead of the United States. In 1970, he says they revealed information of how the Romanovs escaped, and this was in England, but was not allowed to be mass-produced in the United States. The family took a British cruiser. They were assisted from where they were taken prisoner by the United States Army, United States soldiers that were there. They were taken by a British cruiser. They came out of Russia on the Siberian side, went to Malta, and then they set up life in Poland. He says his father's grave, the Tsar of Russia, is marked. It's in Poland. His father died in 1952. His mother's grave is in Poland. She died in 1924. His inheritance began automatically in 1952 at the time of the father's death. They sent Alexei to a military academy, and during World War II, he joined Polish intelligence, where he went inside Russia as a double agent, working against the Soviets as a Polish agent. He was with the Polish army during the war. He did no fighting, of course. He just did intelligence work. He also did some writing for Randolph Hearst, putting down the Rockefellers in the Journal American Newspapers in New York that was once owned by Randolph Hearst. There is an interesting statement by Alexa Romanoff, who worked in double intelligence. He said that Heinrich Himmler, the Nazi, co-worker of Adolf Hitler, was allegedly killed in an automobile accident, a hairpin turn in Germany. He says it didn't happen at all, that Himmler is alive and he's living in the United States. He took on an American name. I suppose, again, it was Alan Dulles and the Galen operation that brought him to this country. He wrote a book about the Romanovs and about their terrible death, because this was the role to keep perpetuating how evil the communists were and how much blood was spilled. The book is called The Hunt for the Tsar. If some of you study these books, and I know many people, many listeners, are collecting these books on Abraham Lincoln and on the Tsar. A book called The Hunt for the Tsar is out, and I'm going to try and get that. Like, I want the one on Abraham Lincoln and the Romanovs, and the Russian, the intrigues of the killing of Lincoln and the Romanov conspiracies. The Hunt for the Tsar, whatever pen name it has, was written by Heinrich Himmler. This is what is passed along, for whatever it's worth, Alexei says. And I think these things are interesting. I think that the biggest problem facing this country is to erase these hoaxes. This is what I try to do. I believe there's three major hoaxes that are intertwined that affect our economy and well-being, our court systems. One is the Howard Hughes hoax, the use of this one man who was drugged, kidnapped for military use. His entire command was taken over by our Pentagon and the CIA and the defense agencies, and they then linked it to the Mormon data banks, the Nazi Interpol records, and the Hughes syndrome that links to these other assassinations is one of the major problems in the United States uncovered. The other one is the killing of the presidents and the senators and the candidates, filling of John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, and the collusion of the courts in covering up those murders. And then the third big story, really, to open up is the successful evacuation of the Romanovs. What really happened to them? Where are their holdings? What did they have? How many more people came over with them? How many Nazis came? What are the links of the present czars to the Nazis in America and around the country that are surfacing? These are big problems, and from week to week on Dialogue Conspiracy, I talk about smaller aspects of them. But those are the three major problems that have to be linked together in order to solve who killed John Kennedy. They're not separate, but they're big, major problems. There's another splinter problem in the United States that I talk about from time to time that I want to mention briefly, because there's two newsletters out, and that's about animal mutilations. We don't know where they're coming from or why they're coming, but they're happening. Ed Sanders has a newsletter. He's a writer who lives in Woodstock, New York. It's called The Cattle Report. You can write to him. It's Box 729 Woodstock in New York, 12498. It's a good, comes out four times a year, a newsletter on where the cattle mutilations are happening. These are instances of livestock, particularly hogs and cows, that are found dead. The testicles are removed. The tongues are removed. They're left in strange positions. There's no footprints or noise. They are put in similar positions around the country, and the livestock are being killed all over the country. And so there's a newsletter out about where they're happening and how they're happening. Now, there's another newsletter coming out from a very fine researcher in Paris, Texas. It's called Stigmata, Project Stigmata, called Livestock Mutilations and Deaths. And I'm not sure this isn't linked to the what I call the Nazification process. I don't know what it means, except they are here and they're very real. And I think if you're interested in this subject, I don't have to go at length about them on Dialogue Conspiracy. Stigmata involves just sending a self-addressed envelope, the large size, stamped with your 13 cents, P.O. Box 1094, Paris, Texas, 75460. If you didn't get that, you write to my home, because I only come here once a week to KLRB, or phone the house. I'll give you the addresses and the sources of the information. Stigmata coming out now from Texas is from a very fine researcher who's done a lot of work on the various assassinations and conspiracies. He talks about the mutilations and the mutilation deaths, and the factual data and how it's so important to get into these aspects. He has a chronicle in the first issue of the 1977 Mute Chronology, because it isn't surfacing in the news, but the local papers carry it. And he has the confirmed mutilations in Arizona in January and in Kentucky in February, Colorado, Texas. In March this year, New Mexico, Texas, Colorado, Washington, April, Alberta, Canada, and May, Colorado and Texas. June was in Texas. July was in Dartmoor, England. 15 ponies mysteriously dead, but apparently they weren't classic cases, but Texas and Colorado. In August, there was Texas, Arkansas, Oklahoma, Oregon, and Colorado. September, Colorado, Missouri, Texas. October, Missouri, Colorado, Colorado, Oregon, Texas, and Iowa. In November, Kansas and Nebraska, and December in Colorado. There's been a lot of links in Ed Sanders' work to the Air Force Base in Colorado and the links of their silencer and their helicopters and the cattle mutilations. He has a number here in this stigmata bulletin. Any fresh mutilation, get word that they'll fly to any site in western USA, send a team. They have to have fresh carcasses within 48 hours. They'll take pictures of the mutilations of the bodies, the positions they're in, how they're moved around, and the genitals and the throats and parts that are removed, and compare them and put them in files. It is a very serious problem, and if you're interested in that, you can take these two newsletters and keep up on what's happening in that sense. Now, in the next few months on Dialogue Conspiracy, I'm going to harp at one theme, one overriding theme, and that has to do with what's coming in the United States, specifically California, which again I call the Nazification state. We have two people running for office for possible governor this year, and if one doesn't get the governorship and is pushed out because one has to lose, he will be appointed to a big job such as FBI chief, or even they talked about Evel Young on the Supreme Court someday. I'm going to talk for the next few weeks about Chief of Police Ed Davis in Los Angeles and Attorney General Evel Younger and also Sheriff Peter Pitches, even though he isn't running for office. I will be writing about them. I'm getting my files in order. I'd like to get out a paperback book or magazine or Xerox story on Evel Younger and Ed Davis. If you have anything you want me to include in your files, mail it to me so we can do a profile of these men. This gang of Younger and Davis, to me, are the epitome of the way murders are covered up, the way the courts are manipulated, and the way high public officials are rewarded with a position even to run for the idea of governor. Of these men with all these unsolved murders and trails of blood behind them is no different than Goering and Goebbels or Himmler or Hitler in Germany. I call the California violent scenes that they've been part and parcel of the Robert Kennedy assassination in Los Angeles, the L.A. slasher case, the Strangler case, the Zebra killings in San Francisco, the SLA formation in the LAPD, the Manson family murders, the killing of the six people at Sharon Tate's home, and the killings of LaBianca's, the Dr. Oder killings in Santa Cruz, Edmund Kemper massacres, the trash bag killer, the Juan Corona frame-up of the migrant farmers, the Chowchilla bus kidnapping, the San Quentin Six trial, the trial of Rochelle McGee and the shootout at Marin County, the Angela Davis case, the secret army organization, the Squad 19 in Los Angeles to kill Richard Nixon, the Chicano killings. I could go on and on. I just can't believe that anyone like Ed Davis would even run for governor of California. New West magazine has a long article on Ed Davis. It's December 19th, 1977, but you can get it at your libraries and copy it. It has a cover. It says, picture of Ed Davis on the cover, and it says, in quotes, "The Power Politics of Ed Davis, a Cop Who Would Be King," by Barry Farrell. There's some quotations in the article. It says, one seasoned observer warns, when truly enormous power falls into the hands of someone like Chief Ed Davis, well, watch out. Another quotation quotes a bumper sticker, Davis will be great if you want a police state. Another quotation about Ed Davis and his work. Davis is being merchandised. Not only does the J. Walter Thompson Agency cover police departments and sell you their placid look, but Mr. Voguery, who I call the number one most dangerous public relations man in the world, is in Washington, D.C. to overturn elections all over the country and make us very, very conservative. Voguery is from the YAF, and still with it, he managed George Wallace's mailing list and other writers. He's managing the campaign of Ed Davis in Los Angeles. It's interesting that Mr. Vogrie managed the campaign of George Wallace, and that Thane Caesar, the man who shot Robert Kennedy from the back of the head and who's been charged with killing Robert Kennedy, was a Wallace worker, and Thane Caesar worked with Ed Davis. Ed Davis covered up the killing of Robert Kennedy. Ed Davis is linked to the CIA, the police department, to the Morma data banks. Johnny Meyer, living in Canada, said that directly from the Los Angeles Police Department goes information on your marijuana slips, your abortion slips. If you sign it, petitions, he sends those directly to the Mormon data banks through a $10 million computer through the Hughes organization. He's inextricably linked to the Summa Corporation. A man worked for the Los Angeles Police Department 17 years with Ed Davis and goes on to be security of the Hughes organization and their links to the assassination teams. He's linked to the Interpol, the international police, and he's been president of the International Police Organization for the last period. He's proud of that. He entertains at a convention in Los Angeles people from the SAVAK, the terrible police force of the Shah of Iran, and from South Korea. He's the president of the International Police Organization. He works, as I say, with the Secret Army Organization. He set up the Squad 19 in his police department, formed the first SWAT teams that had the public cremation of six people burning in Los Angeles dinner time, the SLA. This is a terribly dangerous person. Evel Young works hand in glove with them. If they didn't do anything else, they covered the complete story of the John Kennedy assassination. They're even talking now about Mr. Vandekamp, the district attorney, being appointed chief of the FBI. That would be his payoff for covering up what the Board of Supervisors presented to him on the conspiracy to kill Robert Kennedy. The conspirators get rewarded, they get promoted, they get elected, they get paid off, and I don't think there's any more important problem in the country right now than to expose Ed Davis and Evel Younger, and I hope to be doing that. There's a long article, it's 18 pages or 20 pages, in the Los Angeles Times, December 18th, 1977, a special report on Ed Davis of the police department. It says, how good is he? In 1975 to 76, the LAPD shot 150 people. They killed 60, 41 were unarmed. In 1977, they shot 77 people, 33 died, 60%. Those people shot by the Los Angeles Police Department were not armed, and they've been shooting Chicanos and Mexicans with the flimsiest excuses. And there's been some famous cases. Mr. Burkholder, the scientist who was working on fuel, who graduated from Caltech, who was shot in the street by an agent of the Los Angeles Police Department. The man was nude and didn't have weapons and obviously unarmed, maybe freaked out from some drug, but they knew who he was. He worked at the Veterans Organization and was working on fuel. I will be talking and getting books together and exposing these people. I just can't believe that Evel Younger and Ed Davis could be linked to so many of these cases and so much violence. And next week I will go into the lawsuit against the Los Angeles Police Department that three widows of guards killed at the time of the San Quentin shootout in August of 1971 filed against the LAPD because of the allegations that a gun was put in that prison. A .38 was taken by the LAPD officers up to San Quentin the day of the shootout, and they are making the LAPD defendants for the death of prison guards on the allegations that the police provided the gun inside the prison and their husbands were killed. The gun was seen in the prison. It was later seen by Lewis Tackwood in the office of Robert Keel, in charge of the criminal conspiracy section after the shootout. And this lawsuit I'll go into in detail next week. Well, that's it for Dialogue Conspiracy. A lot of news, a lot of unhappy things, a lot of pressure of cover-ups every week, but we keep trudging along, and I'll bring you more next week, the continuing story of Ed Davis and Evel Younger, and some more news on these various conspiracies. This is Mae Bressel, and I'll see you next week. This is Dialogue Conspiracy.
You've been listening to Dialogue Conspiracy with Mae.